Welcome to December. This is the last month of the year, but it also tends to be an unbelievably busy month, an unbelievably full month, because it is the last month in the year. So many calendars are ending this month. For example, if you're in school, your first semester is likely ending. So as a result, you likely have a number of exams coming up, a number of projects, papers that are due, presentations, maybe special programs and extracurricular activities that you're in. In the workplace, similar vibe, projects are coming to an end. Maybe your fiscal year ends, so you got to close the books. And along with that, maybe you have some work parties, some social gatherings in that realm. On a personal level, maybe you're just have some personal goals you want to get to before the end of the year. Tax-wise, you want to do some tax stuff, some moving around, some assets or whatever. That's all happening this month. It's a super busy month just for that. And by the way, it's also Advent, that season that begins the church year in which we anticipate and remember the birth of Jesus, but also anticipate his return. And so along with that, we want to mark this in a special way. Part of that was what we just saw here with an Advent wreath, but there's a number of events that are coming up this month that I want to make sure that you're aware of, lest they get lost in the many things that are going on in other aspects of your life. So just as a heads up, next week, we have a special Christmas presentation. That's during the English service, so just come as normal. Special thanks to Beth, Mina, and Rachel that are helping even now our kids get ready for this. On the 20th of December, we have our annual candlelight service. This will be at 7 o'clock for our English community. This is a short family-friendly service, and then at Mandarin, we'll be at 8 o'clock. If you've come to these in the past, you know that sometimes we get to see people we haven't seen for a while, and it's always be nice to chat with them afterwards. Well, this year we're trying something new, because immediately following our candlelight service, we're having the Christmas Cafe downstairs. Special thanks to Claudia that's helping to spearhead this. More information will be coming up, but basically just a place to hang out for a little bit, to chat with people that you haven't seen for a while downstairs. The triple header continues that weekend because on Saturday morning is our youth Christmas party. We'll be serving at St. Vincent House and coming back here for lunch and a party following. And then to round out that weekend on Sunday morning, Grace is working on a special Christmas sing. We've done this in the past. We'll do it again this year. Just coming during the English service, we'll sing and rejoice about the coming of Jesus. That's a lot to remember. How do you remember all that? Well, there's one QR code that's been in your bulletin right now. It's also on the screen right now. This just links to our digital bulletin. If you haven't checked this out, I would commend this to you. It's simply what it sounds like. It's a digital bulletin in the sense that it has the same information in your paper bulletin, but because it's digital, it gives you a lot more room. It's hyperlinked, etc. It also has all those events in it as well. In addition, it has our mission spotlight that's been in our bulletin recently. It has the link to that, and just also has a link to our newsletter, which comes out every Wednesday to keep you in the know what's going on. So I'd commend that to you. If you're having trouble remembering all of that. Well, as we look at Hosea, this quote came out to me. The most minor thing about the minor prophets is their place in the life of the church today. If you know the Bible, Hosea is one of the minor prophets. It's minor in the sense that it's a bit shorter than some of the other prophets like Isaiah or Jeremiah, but it ought not be minor in our lives. In fact, as we press into it for the next few weeks, you'll see it's the impact it has all the year, but certainly during the season of Advent. If you want to follow along, I invite you, as always, to follow along in the Pew Bible. 772 is what we'll be this morning. Let me give you a little context of what's going on here historically. We saw that conveniently in verse 1. The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, son of Beeri, during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and during the reign of Jeroboam, son of Jehoash, king of Israel. So a little bit of context here. If you're familiar with the Old Testament narrative, you know that after King Solomon, Kingdom of Israel divides into two nations, Israel in the north, Judah in the south, and you see them referenced there. And Hosea prophesies, is the last, speaks to the northern kingdom of Israel right before they fall. And during this season in Israel, it's a bit of a tumultuous time. There's six kings over 30 years, and many of them are murdered. It's just a dark time, honestly, without a lot of hope. And that vibe comes into our text as God indicts his people, because it begins in chapter 1 with a number of hopeless relationships. A number of hopeless relationships, the first of which being a shameful marriage. A shameful marriage. Let me reread just one verse here that opens this shameful marriage and exposes it for what it is. When the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, "Go marry a promiscuous woman and have children with her, For like an adulterous wife, this land is guilty of unfaithfulness to the Lord. So the picture here is as brazen as it seems. It's the stigma that is bound up in Hosea's relationship with his wife. He is to marry a promiscuous woman, an adulterous wife, a wife that would be unfaithful to him. And indeed, certainly in our context, and certainly in that context then, there's stigma related to this. There's alienation related to this. There's shame related to this. For example, imagine he introduces his new wife to his parents. They're wondering what her profession is. Is she in finance? Is she in business? Is she a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer? What is she? Well, it's awkward. Or imagine you go to the Christmas party, for example, at the office, and everyone's introducing their spouses. Oh, this is Susan. She's in finance. Hosea, what's your wife? Well, she does finance something. She does sell something. But, you know, it's just awkward, right? You sense the stigma already in verse 2 of this relationship. But not just external stigma in that society, but internally. Can you imagine how challenging this would have been during their honeymoon? Hosea is always wondering about her wandering eyes as a result, because he knows this is an unfaithful woman. His heart would be broken. It's that same sense that you see kind of in this picture. It's an older picture, but like, oh, what's going on here? Gomer always wondering about her wandering eyes. The question then is obvious. Why? Why would God call his prophet Hosea to marry this woman, this wife who will be unfaithful? Now, if you know the Old Testament, there's a sense in which God asking his prophet to do something that is a bit of a head scratcher is not entirely new. For example, in Isaiah, at that time, the Lord spoke through Isaiah, son of Amos. He said to him, Isaiah, take off your sackcloth from your body and the sandals from your feet. And he did so, going around stripped and barefoot. Isaiah goes around barefoot and naked for 3 years. Jeremiah, this is what the Lord said to me, make a yoke out of straps and crossbars and put it on your neck. So he has this yoke on him to indicate to Zedekiah, you need to submit to Nebuchadnezzar. Or finally, one more from Ezekiel. Now, son of man, take a block of clay, put it in front of you, and draw the city of Jerusalem on it. Lay siege to it, erect siege works against it, build a ramp up, set up its camps against it, and put battering rams around it. Then take an iron pan, place it on an iron wall between you and the city, and turn your face toward it. It will be under siege, and you shall besiege it. This will be a sign to the people of Israel. In other words, God is asking Ezekiel to almost play with these toys to indicate that siege will happen if you don't repent. So barefoot and naked, yoke on your neck, playing with these toys. God asks his prophets at times to do things that are a bit head-scratching. So why, then, does God call Hosea to marry a woman who would be unfaithful? Well, we don't have to wonder because the text literally tells us, do this because like an adulterous wife, this land, God's people, Israel, is guilty of unfaithfulness to the Lord. It literally tells us why. In other words, this marriage to an unfaithful woman is to be illustrative. This is to be a picture, just as your wife, Hosea, will be unfaithful to you. So God's people have been unfaithful to God. She's promiscuous. She broke the marriage covenant. It's a shameful marriage. But there's more. Not only do we see a shameful marriage, we see what I'm calling convicting children. There's three children that are mentioned here, and each are rather convicting about the state of affairs between God's people and God himself. Now, we know the names are important. If you listen carefully as Mark read the text in verses 4, 6, and 9, there's this formula. The Lord said, call him or call her this and that. These are God-given names, and they matter what God calls them. For example, verses 4 to 5, we meet Jezreel. Now, Jezreel refers back to 2 Kings 9 and 10, in which this guy named Jehu is in this conflict in the valley of Jezreel, and he's trying to get power. And his reign begins and ends with violence. In fact, shortly after Hosea, Jehu's descendants are assassinated. And so it conjures up all these images when you mention Jezreel. And that's the same idea here. Israel, you will be defeated. In fact, it literally says that in the text. I will put an end to the kingdom of Israel. In that day, I will break Israel's bow in the valley of Jezreel. So that God would call this first son Jezreel is a reminder that Israel will fall into defeat. They will be defeated. There's military defeat here. This horrible thing is going to happen. It's similar in our day and age, if you're familiar with World War II, name your son Hiroshima. Or more modern, name your son 9/11. Like it conjures up a lot of not so great feelings. That's the idea that's going on here. There's a conviction that's happening even through the birth of this first son. Now there's two other children that come forth, but did you listen carefully to the text? Because the way that their birth and their coming into this world is described is a little bit unique. Let me see if you can pick it up. In verse 3, we find out that Jezreel is Gomer bears a son. She bore him, Hosea, a son. Now listen to how that's kind of unique and how the preface to the other two children is. Gomer gave birth to a daughter. Gomer had another son. It's a bit different if you listen carefully. Whereas Jezreel is given, is his son, we're not so sure whether these two latter kids are in fact Hosea's children. Because remember, this is an unfaithful woman here. For example, a little bit later on in chapter 2, Israel is described thus. They are the children of adultery. Their mother has been unfaithful and has conceived them in disgrace. So it would not be surprising if those latter two children were born not with Hosea. It's a reminder every day of her unfaithfulness. Can you imagine every day seeing those latter two kids and being reminded that you're here because my wife was unfaithful? Let's press into these last two kids' names, because again, they're important as well. Lo Ruhamah, which simply means not loved. That in and of itself is painful. Imagine naming your child, you're not loved. But what makes it worse, what adds insult to injury, what drives salt in the wound, is the context. While Israel, you will not be loved, I will love Judah. Remember, in the context here, divided kingdom, Israel in the north, Judah in the south, and the text says, I'm not going to love you, Israel in the north, but I'll love Judah in the south. I will show love to Judah, and I will save them. This is akin to sibling rivalry. Again, imagine you have an older brother. You're named, I don't love you, but I'll love your younger brother or your older brother. Like, that's just ripe for conflict. That's ripe for conviction. That's ripe for difficulty. That feels dirty. Well, that's actually what happens. Judah, if you know the rest of the story, in Isaiah 36 and 37, God delivers Judah. Assyria defeats Israel in the north. They attack Judah in the south. They're conquering almost everything. They're about to take over Jerusalem. And the night before, 186,000 people, 185,000 Assyrians die and they flee. And so God does save Judah at the point. I don't love you, Israel, but I love Judah. And finally, the last child is simply Lo Ami. And this is perhaps, if you can believe this, the worst one. It simply means not my people. Now, if you know the Old Testament narrative, what defines Israel? What was their clarion call? What it was above all else? What were they? Were they nomads? Did they like pigeons? Did they like hunt? No, they were the people of God. Remember in Exodus 6, I'll take you as my own people and I will be your God, God says. You will know that I am the Lord your God who brought you out of under the yoke of the Egyptians. The one thing that defined the people of God, namely being the people of God here, is revoked. You are not my people. Think about yourself. What defines you? Like at school, how are you known? What kind of makes you feel good and proud? Like, top of the class, I'm the smartest kid in the school. Or I am just the most attractive Asian in my school. Or whatever it is for you. Like, what is it? But what if that's taken away? How would that make you feel? The very platform upon which you're building your reality, swiped out from under your feet. Perhaps that's akin to what's happening here. They were the people of God, but oh, lo ami, not my people. This indicts them clearly. But what about us? As we think about ourselves, this should indict us as well. We should be able to say, oh, I can see like Israel that I am at times wayward. I am at times unfaithful. I am at times like a prostitute, plying for whoever will have the highest price to receive me. Are you willing to say, I have been spiritually promiscuous? I am a spiritual adulterer. Or to use the ESV language, which again feels so gripping and maybe crass and dirty in my ears, I'm a spiritual whore. I whore after other gods. I'm not going to lie, this language feels, at least to my ears, almost repulsive. And after last week, I thought, okay, we're done with the gritty imagery. Remember last week, end of Judges? Wow. We saw some imagery there. We heard some imagery here. We walked through a text of the last few chapters of Judges that was appalling. And after last week, I was like, wow, I'm glad we're done with that. But then I remembered, oh, preaching on Hosea 1 this morning. Imagine this. Are you willing to say, I've been a spiritual whore? I am spiritually promiscuous. And to drive this home, imagine you were to treat your spouse like you treat God. And how would that flow? If you're not married, imagine you treat a dear friend like sometimes we treat God. A classmate, even a good colleague that you care about. What would happen if how we treat God, we treated our spouse like that? We'll go with that motif because that's closest to the text here. Imagine you treated your spouse like we so often treat God. So for example, let's kind of rest in this. Let's camp out here for a moment and think about that. What would happen if you treated your spouse like we so often treat God? For example, sins of commission. God calls us not to do this, but we do it, just straight up. We use his name in vain. What would happen if you spoke that way, spoke about your spouse that way? Or sins of omission. God calls us to do certain things, but we don't do it. He calls us to love our neighbor. We don't do that. What if your spouse called you to do something, but you just didn't do it? Or even maybe more appropriate, ignoring God. I mean, so often we ignore God. We're fine until my crisis, but right now, I'm fine. In fact, life is fine without you. Now, in certain set of God, what if you spoke to your spouse that way? Your spouse asks you a question. Hey, babe, what time is it? Silence. Or, hey, babe, did you read the text I sent you? I spent a lot of time on that text, crafting that text for you. Did you read it? Ignore it. What would happen if you treated your spouse like we so often treat God? So, for example, imagine a crisis, right? So often, even the most nominal Christian, during a crisis, will pray. Once the crisis has passed, I don't need to pray anymore. God has become this kind of cosmic fire fighting apparatus, a fire extinguisher. I'll use you when I need you, God. What would happen if you treated your spouse that way? I just need you to make a meal, and after that, after I'm satiated, after I'm full, see ya. What would happen if you treated your spouse the way we so often treat God? What would happen if we did that? Or for example, imagine there's a crisis, and you pray, and for whatever reason, God doesn't fix it. And so you blame God. What would happen if you treated your spouse that same way? There's a crisis in your life, and for whatever reason, she or he can't fix it, and then you blame her. What would happen if you treated your spouse like we so often treat God? I think just this cursory kind of exploration of that idea yields the reality, wow, if I treated my spouse like I so often treat God, ignoring, taking for granted, manipulating, using, I'd be in a bad place. My spouse would properly say to me, you use me, you manipulate me, you ignore me. The language that is used in Hosea is meant to grip us because it is so repulsive. I mean, it's adulterous language here. And adultery violates personal relationship, which leads us into a really key insight. Sin is not simply breaking a rule. Sin is breaking a heart. Sin is relational. It breaks the heart of the Lord when we sin. It's not just breaking a rule. The true nature of sin breaks relationship. It breaks that relationship with our Lord. Here's a lengthy quote, but I think the author here gets it. Hosea boldly compares sin to adultery in order to demonstrate how terribly destructive it is to a person's relationship with God. Sin is not a minor incidental mistake that we can be winked at, as if it really does not matter. Sin is a devastating affront to the exclusive love commitment one makes to God. Sin is a forsaking of loyalty to one person. The shocking vulgarity of the text is purposely designed to open the interpreter's eyes to the surprising way God views the unfaithfulness of his people. Sin is not petty or something one can just overlook. It is a devastating betrayal of trust that goes to the heart of any relationship. If an accountant sins by stealing money, can the boss trust him to handle the company's money? If a babysitter is caught on videotape physically abusing the children, can a mother trust this person with her children? If a boss catches an employee lying about sales contacts, can that employee be trusted with an important new account? No. Sin undermines the basis of any relationship between two people Sin destroys a person's relationship with God. Do you feel that? I feel like so often we are so lax when it comes to sin. Like, you know, no big deal. None of us are perfect. Wink, wink. We must feel the weight of this. This is meant to grip us. Are you then able to say, I'm a spiritual whore? I've committed spiritual adultery against God. I've been promiscuous, and I've tarnished and broken that relationship with God when I sin. Again, sin is not just breaking rules. It's breaking a relationship. It's breaking the heart of the Lord. It's good, though, that that's here. When we can press into that and say, faithfully, I'm a spiritual whore. I've committed spiritual adultery. I get what Hosea is talking about here. It guards us against spiritual elitism. It guards us against self-righteousness. If we can recognize, hey, I'm like Gomer. Sin is not minor. Sin breaks relationships. Sin is repulsive. Okay, then we're starting to get some hope in an otherwise hopeless chapter here. It reminds me of Isaiah 66. These are the ones God looks for. Those who are humble and contrite in spirit, who tremble at my word. In other words, those who guard against self-righteousness, those who guard against pride. And one way is to recognize the depth of depravity and the darkness of our own sin. But hope is dawning, and the text continues in verse 10. Because we have a hope-giving God. Let's take a look at this here. After all this, you know, hope-sucking reality, now we find out this beautiful truth. Yet, the Israelites will be like the sand on the seashore, which cannot be measured or counted. In the place where it was said to them, you are not my people. They will be called the children of the living God. The people of Judah and the people of Israel will come together. They will appoint one leader and will come up out of land, for great will be the day of Jezreel. Say of your brothers, my people, and of your sisters, my loved ones. In other words, the picture here is of restoration. In fact, Hosea's name itself means he, that is God, delivers. And next week we'll see the way God shows his love towards his people. And honestly, it's a bit surprising how he does it, but he shows that love. Now, the story of Hosea continues, and we know, thankfully, the fuller story. It's a similar story, but it's a better story. It's a story fulfilled ultimately in Jesus. And as one author writes, Jesus' faithfulness to the Father undoes the judgment of for unfaithfulness represented by each of Hosea's children. Instead of God scatters Israel, through Jesus, God promised to gather his people from every nation, tribe, people, and language. Instead of not loved, lo ruhamah, through Jesus, God demonstrates just how much he loves us. Instead of not my people, lo ami, through Jesus, we are now the people of God. In other words, Jesus' faithfulness on the cross makes the church, which has been so unfaithful, faithful. He redeems us from our sin. Hence, in Revelation, we can rejoice. As it says, let us rejoice and be glad and give him glory, for the wedding of the Lamb has come, and his bride has made herself ready. Fine linen, bright and clean, was given her to wear. Fine linen stands for the righteous acts of God's holy people. In other words, whereas we see in Hosea this blemished bride, this unfaithful bride, we know that through Jesus, for those who put their trust in him, there's redemption and there's the cleansing of the word that makes the people who have been unfaithful faithful, because we are clothed in with the righteousness of Jesus. And it's only in him that that righteousness is found. So as we think about Christmas, what can you do to have a great Christmas? Here's my answer I would submit for your thinking. As you want to have a great Christmas or a great Christmas season, perhaps it already is a great Christmas because of what Christ has done 2,000 years ago. And therefore, we should focus our hope there if we want true hope, because God and God alone gives hope. In other words, what we want to guard against as we enter Advent and as we enter the Christmas season again, guard against hoping and sentimentality. Everything is dripping with saccharine sweet sentimentality during the Christmas season. But sentimentality is thin, it's weak, and it's deeply shallow. For example, think about this picture. Like this lovely photo, right? It encapsulates so much of what at least people in this part of the world think about when it comes to Christmas. It's warm, it's cozy. You can imagine the snow falling outside. It's peaceful. There's presence here. Okay, now think about this. Even if, as you walk through this Advent season, as you walk into the Christmas holiday, even if it's cold and horrible and your heat goes out, it's going to be okay. Because if you hope ultimately in the God of hope who gives true hope, it'll be okay. Because that's where your hope is found. It's not in your heating system. If for whatever reason your presents don't arrive on time or you don't even get any physical presents, it's going to be okay. You know why? Because you put your hope in the God of hope that gives true hope in Jesus. If it's chaotic, like if this is so peaceful and serene, if it's chaotic and crazy and everything's upside down and topsy-turvy, guess what? It's going to be okay. Because you put your hope in the God of hope, and he alone gives hope. If the meal comes out horribly, if your oven doesn't work, if they run out of food at the store, it's going to be okay. You know why? Because your hope is not in the meal. Your hope ultimately is in Jesus, who has achieved for us what we could never do for ourselves. If your Christmas card doesn't get there on time, or you can't get the photo of your family that's perfect, it's okay. Because your hope is not in the card. Your hope is not in the photo of your family. Your hope is in the God of hope that gives true hope. Or finally, if your travel plans go awry, if everything gets canceled, it's a huge snap, it's okay. Because your hope is not in travel. Your hope is in the God of hope who alone can give hope. Let me flip it to maybe try one more way to get this across. How could you have a horrible, frustrating, exasperating Christmas? Here's the answer. Hope in the wrong things. If you can hope in the wrong things, sentimentality, everything's perfect, no chaos, everything's just like this, that's the formula for a horrible Christmas. Because inevitably, something will fall down. Something will let you down. Something will fall short. Something will go awry. Something will go off the rails. And if because your hope was built there, there goes your hope as well. So, as we walk into Advent, as we walk into this Christmas season, may you hope in God alone, because he alone gives true hope. That was true in the 8th century when Hosea was writing. That was true in the 1st century when hope was born. And that's true in the 21st century as well. Let's pray together. Father, would you help our eyes to be fixed upon Jesus so that we can have true hope. Lord, you are the God of hope, and in you alone is found hope. So Lord, help us this season, in all seasons, but particularly this season, to find true hope in Jesus, the one who has laid his life down for us that we might be made right, who even in our unfaithfulness pursued us, so that when we trust in him, we are made faithful and right. For this we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.
May we hope in God alone.